Welcome, and thank you for joining us for the NAHU Healthcare Happy Hour, the official podcast of the National Association of Health Underwriters. This week's podcast includes a special discussion with Suzanne Delbanco from the Catalyst for Payment Reform and NAHU CEO Janet Troutwine. Suzanne and Janet discuss the changing healthcare marketplace, the need for employers to shift towards value-based strategies, what every employer should be doing to shift toward higher value thinking, and more. Before we begin, as a reminder, please take a moment to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or Stitcher and to rate us. The podcast is posted every Friday on these platforms ahead of being distributed through NAHU's member-exclusive health policy newsletter, The Washington Update, giving you a head start on your weekly healthcare happy hour. This week, we are excited to welcome Suzanne Delbanco, the Executive Director of Catalyst for Payment Reform, an independent, nonprofit corporation working to catalyze employers, public purchasers, and others to implement strategies that produce higher value healthcare and improve the functioning of the healthcare marketplace. Suzanne holds a PhD in public policy from the Goldman School of Public Policy and an MPH from the School of Public Health at the University of California, Berkeley. NAHU CEO Janet Troutwine is also joining us for today's discussion. Janet?
Well, Suzanne, thanks so much for being with us today. I'd like to jump right in. This is a topic I know a lot of our members are familiar with, but some of them are not. And then we have a lot of people who listen to our podcasts who aren't members of NAHU as well. So let's get started. First of all, we know who Catalyst for Payment Reform is, but I'm not sure that all of our listeners do. So could you provide us some background on who your organization is, the goals, and a little bit about how we've partnered together to talk about value-based care?
Absolutely. Thank you, Janet, so much for having me on. And it's always a fun conversation with you about what's going on in the world of value-based care. So Catalyst for Payment Reform is a national independent nonprofit organization. We're a 501c3, so that means we've got an educational focus. And we have always tried since our inception to provide thought leadership to and coordination among employers and other big healthcare purchasers who want to get better value out of their healthcare spending. And of course, as our name implies, Catalyst for Payment Reform, changing the way we pay doctors and hospitals has been a focus of ours. When we got started in 2010, there was very little attempt to change how we were paying them. We were, wholly dependent on fee-for-service, except for in a few markets around the country where there was some capitation. And, we knew that fee-for-service, when you pay, individually for one unit of care at a time, you're going to encourage providers to do more care and to do more expensive care to generate revenue. And there was really no tie to quality or efficiency or anything like that. So CPR really came together to try to change that and come up with new ways of paying for care and evaluate them and figure out how to move forward. But we've got a wonderfully diverse membership. We have large private employers, but also a growing number of state Medicaid employee and retiree agencies. And we even have our first nonprofit. We have a university. We've got a union trust fund. So it's really a mix of purchasers who all come together with the same goal. And, we typically call ourselves CPR because we think the healthcare system does need CPR. We do focus primarily on payment reform, but we also recognize that there's a need to align incentives and to make the marketplace function better overall. So we also get into areas related to transparency of prices and quality, benefit design, which of course is something that your members are very familiar with and expert in, provider network designs. We hear a lot of talk today about narrow and tiered networks. And we even try to educate our members about the changing provider landscape and how much consolidation there's been and what that means for the ability to get good value. So we had a great opportunity to partner with NAHU, forgetting now, Janet, if it was 2 or 3 years back, to provide some education to your membership around what's happening in this space and what can they do as trusted advisors to their employer customers, to help them be more strategic and ultimately buy healthcare in a way that gets them, higher quality, more affordable care for their populations.
Well, you all have done such unbelievably great work in this area, but if you had to name just one or two things in terms of areas you could point to that say, you know, this is how the marketplace has changed since we've started doing this. This is how I know we're making a difference. What would a couple of those things be?
Well, the first and most obvious, I think, is just the amount of payment reform we have happening now. When CPR got started in 2010, we did a sort of unofficial query to a few health plans and asked them how much of their payment at that time was tied to performance in some way. That's the phrase we used at that time. And they said somewhere between 1% and 3%. So basically, out of every dollar, you know, we were paying to doctors and hospitals through these big national health plans, there was just a tiny portion that came with any kind of incentive for the provider to care about quality or efficiency or, you know, their use of resources. Now, based on research we've done in a variety of settings, we estimate that we're at about 50%. So there's been a real sea change in how we pay for care. And while CPR is not solely responsible for that change, we do think we can take a lot of credit for what's happened in the commercial sector. You know, the Affordable Care Act really outlined a blueprint for payment reform for Medicare, and we've certainly benefited from the momentum that created. But it's our members who are pressuring, you know, the big national plans to change how they were paying for care that I think can take a lot of the credit. The other area where we've had influence, and there's still more work to be done, just like there is with payment reform, is around price transparency. So some of our founding members were eager to implement what's called reference pricing. It's an approach to benefit design where the employer sets what they think is a reasonable price for a service and then requires their population members to pay anything above that out of pocket if they choose to go somewhere more expensive. And this has been applied in the past to, you know, health plan premiums and pharmacy, but it's really just been in the last, you know, less than a decade that we've been applying this to healthcare services like screening colonoscopies or, you know, total joint replacements. And they found that they couldn't put those benefit designs in place if there wasn't a place for their employees to go to see what things cost. How could they decide if they were going to choose a provider that meets the reference price if there wasn't transparent information? So we sparked the movement to price transparency. And now fast forward, you know, sort of 7-8 years later, and most major health insurance companies have annotations to their provider directories now that show how much things are likely to cost a patient out of pocket. Some states have even put websites into place. And while we're still not in a perfect place in terms of the consistency of data available and how accurate it is and how easily accessible it is, we have made big strides. And I think the healthcare system understands that, you know, price transparency is an essential ingredient of a high value system going forward.
So I'm starting to see a lot more attention in this area, sort of all of a sudden, and maybe even in the last few months even, but certainly more this year. Why do you think there's a need now? And why are people paying more attention to it? And why do you think that is? Why do employers need to pay more attention now? Why do their brokers need to shift the way they think about these things? What is the impetus that's pushing so much energy on the subject right now?
Now, when you say the subject, Janet, just to clarify, are you talking about payment reform, price transparency, or both?
I think both there, because I'm hearing so much more about, we've always heard a lot about transparency, but I'm hearing a lot more about all of these strategies from a lot of people that didn't really seem that interested in talking about it before. And I was just curious if you thought there was any particular thing that triggered all of this, or it's just a combination of things.
Yeah, I mean, I think in a system as complex as this, it's most likely a combination. I mean, what comes to my mind is, you know, healthcare costs continue to grow. While we haven't seen the growth as rapid in the last few years as, you know, it had been in the past, it's still growing. And the U.S., you know, and companies based here still have to compete globally. And the fact that healthcare is cutting into their bottom line so much, and we don't have better health outcomes to show for it compared to other countries, I think that's just always a mounting motivator. But beyond that, we're sort of in an interesting time where we are seeing from surveys that Americans are more willing than they've been in the past to make trade-offs between choice and affordability. So in the past, employers were really afraid of disruption. They did not want to rock the boat with employees who might have had a relationship with a doctor or were comfortable with a particular health insurance company. They didn't want to create change. They wanted to let things lie, you know, as long as they could tolerate it, because they felt that that was the ticket to keeping employees happy. But, you know, fast forward to where we are today and, you know, the data coming out about how few Americans have enough savings to even meet a deductible and healthcare cutting into wages and wages not really growing because of healthcare costs. I think more and more Americans, and this is true from survey findings, you know, are willing to make that trade-off. And so that then opens doors to all kinds of innovation, whether it's restricting the choice of providers that Americans have in return for lower premiums and lower cost sharing, if that means, you know, steering them to particular providers for, you know, complex or very expensive services because certain providers we know are better at handling them or have more expertise, more efficiency. All of these now become opportunities. And so therefore, with that comes payment reform, new provider network designs, you know, new benefit designs, the need for transparency around quality and price. So I think shifting American attitudes are part of it.
So what I hear you saying is that, yes, we've got a lot of things we need to do to change the way we pay providers, but we also need to make sure that we're providing enough consumer information in the form of transparency, as well as the plan design to make all of these things work together to achieve the best results. Is that what I'm hearing you say here?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I think we've led the thinking on is the need to line up incentives from the patient all the way to the provider. So, you know, we started out focusing on payment reform. Obviously, benefit design came up in this conversation pretty quickly, but we can't think about them in isolation. So let's say we are paying a provider under a shared savings arrangement where there's a target budget they're working toward for a population of patients. If they spend less than that budget, they get to share in some of the savings with the payer. But imagine then if the patients have zero incentive to shop around, be careful about the choices they make, whether it's choice of treatments or choice of providers, and you know they really don't have any incentive to control their spending or utilization of healthcare, well, they're going to be at odds, you know, with a provider. Or another example would be, let's say a provider is being held responsible for certain levels of quality performance around preventive screenings or, you know, secondary preventive services, let's say for a patient who already has diabetes but needs to come in for regular checkups. If the benefit design of the patient is such that they refrain from seeking care because they don't want to spend money because their coverage doesn't encourage them to go get the care that they need, then the provider's not going to do well in that pay-for-performance model. They're not going to get their bonus, and the patient's not going to get the care that they need. So there's a lot of thinking that needs to be done across all of these things. And there's a fair amount of evidence that consumers don't use price information and quality information in making choices as often as some of us might have thought they would. But that information needs to be there to assure them if they are making a choice of a more narrow network or they are deciding to go with their employer's direction to a center of excellence, they need to be able to double check that they're not going to be hurt, you know, on the quality side. And that information being transparent is critical as well to competition among providers and making sure that they feel the motivation to continue improving the value of what they're offering.
So to kind of paint a picture about this, do you have any stories that you are able to share with us about, you know, where something has worked to give a visual or to give a good example of how this all comes together when it works right?
Yeah. You know, we've had a lot of fun this last year doing some case studies on things that our members and other employers have done to be innovative around whether it's, again, their benefit design, provider network design, provider payment. And so there's a lot of different stories. I think, though, one of my favorite ones, I'll go back a few years, is around the area of maternity care. You know, maternity care in this country finally is making headlines because I have been bothered for the last decade that quality in this area is really sub where it should be. There is too much intervention in labor and delivery for what is considered to be high quality, safe care for women. There's been headlines about maternal mortality being on the rise in this country. And here we are, you know, one of the most wealthy countries in the world with access to great healthcare. And yet, particularly minority populations, we have really horrible figures around maternal mortality. And anyway, long story short, you know, one of the things that had really become a bad practice and quite prevalent was early elective deliveries. Women choosing to have babies before their full term, either through a cesarean delivery or inducing labor. And of course, you know, women could make this choice, but if their doctors and hospitals said, no, that's not healthy, they wouldn't have proceeded. But doctors and hospitals were supporting this. And, you know, we were getting to a place where these were almost common. And in South Carolina, there was a partnership among all of the different stakeholders in maternity care called the Birth Outcomes Initiative. And they worked for a good year on quality improvement efforts around early elective deliveries and other things as well. And while they did create some reduction in early elective deliveries after a period of time, some of the providers who couldn't get their recalcitrant colleagues to come along with changing their practices, you know, approached the Medicaid program, the Blue Cross Blue Shield of South Carolina, and said, we need you to stop paying for these. If you keep paying for them, they'll keep happening. But if you stop paying for them, we think practice will change. And sure enough, the proportion of births that were early elective deliveries, you know, really plummeted. And so to me, that's an example of where quality improvement on the part of providers, as well as payment change and payment policy on the part of payers, really made a difference. That's one great story. Do you want me to continue?
Yeah, if you have one more, I think that people would like to hear it because it just helps them visualize what the possibilities are.
Sure. You know, another story that I think I can point to is a case study we just released recently of Walmart and its Center of Excellence program for spine surgery. And I think people who, you know, sort of pay attention to the thoughts about what's appropriate care when it comes to low back pain know that typically people are much better off if they get physical therapy than if they do almost anything else. But often just because everybody's in a rush, you know, we get referred to orthopedists who, you know, then maybe more often than they should suggest that people should get spinal fusions or other kinds of spine surgery, which can be, any surgery is risky and can create potential harm for patients. And if the outcomes aren't sure to be good, it's really not worth going through. And recognizing this, Walmart created a Centers of Excellence programs where they identified providers who they felt really followed the evidence and had the expertise needed to judge appropriately when a patient should proceed with the surgery and not. And they created, you know, a benefit design that really encouraged associates to try the centers, and the centers were paid in a bundled fashion, so sort of a package price. But there were two bundles, one for the evaluation of the patient and one for the actual procedure. And they found that quite often patients who had been referred by providers back home for spine surgery really were not appropriate candidates. And so rather than being put at risk, all the risks that come with surgeries, and not having outcomes that were favorable after all that, they were referred instead to more appropriate courses of treatment. And so that involved benefit design, it involved payment reform in terms of the bundled payment approach, and, you know, smartly separating out the evaluation so that the provider would still get compensated for deciding that a patient wasn't appropriate. So I love that story, and I think there's a lot to learn from it and possibilities of replication and scaling up of that approach.
So let's say that someone listening out here, either they're an employer or they're a broker, they've not really been involved with this at all, and they just want to take that first step. You know, one thing that they could do to shift, not just to doing something, but maybe just to thinking about things differently. Is there one thing that would get them started or one really important thing that someone just can't leave out? Anything like that?
Yeah, I mean, I think the most important thing is to start asking questions. So whoever is listening, chances are if they're in the healthcare system, you know, they're interacting with health insurance companies, and they really are the agents of employers when it comes to contracting with providers, negotiating how much they pay those providers, you know, administering claims, payments, and all that. And so, you know, they're really at the intersection where we think a lot of change can occur. And so starting to ask questions of those health insurance companies, what are you doing related to payment reform? Where have you seen successes? Where have you seen failures? What are you going to try next? What are you thinking about the benefit designs that most effectively today convince consumers to try getting their care from high value providers? You know, what do you do about the poor performing providers in your network? Do you keep them in your network? How do people know, you know, that they're poor performers and maybe to choose a different provider? I think just asking questions of the health plan is very effective. It educates the questioner, but it also shows the health plan what's of concern to whether it's the employer customer or the insurance agent or broker or benefit consultant, it lets them know that these are issues that people care about. And of course, there's more you can do beyond that. You can put these kinds of questions into formal requests for information or requests for proposals. You can put your expectations into ASO contracts or other contracts. All of these things are actionable at some level, but just to start the conversation.
Are there initiatives that are out there that are going on with employers and policymakers that are things that we should be paying attention to that maybe might trigger either a legislative or a regulatory solution that might push these things along?
Yeah, it's a great question. When I think about what might be most in need of legislation or regulation, I mean, I'll share that CPR comes from the perspective that there's a lot that can be done in the marketplace before we turn to policy solutions. But an area that I really am concerned about that I think could require policy intervention at some point is not payment reform, it's not benefit design, it's not necessarily provider network design, but it has to do with the imbalance of power in the marketplace. There's been so much provider consolidation, really in many markets now, you know, hospitals are highly concentrated, physician groups are increasingly highly concentrated, and their ability to sort of call the shots and name the price is threatening all of these efforts that employers and their agents and brokers and consultants are trying to put into place to innovate and make care higher value and higher quality more affordable. And so something has to be done at some point if marketplace initiatives are not successful, because it almost becomes rearranging deck chairs on the Titanic to tinker with how we pay providers if the price they're charging is astronomical. So that's an area where I really think about, you know, policy and potential for policy intervention. It's not even just about prices. It can also be about the practices that providers put in place that really diminish the options that those who are buying healthcare or administering healthcare benefits have in terms of benefit design and provider network design. If they're powerful enough, they might say, you can't cut me out of your network, or you can't steer patients away from me. So I think that's the issue that's most on my mind.
Yeah, I would agree. That's a really critical area. Well, I want to turn to something a lot lighter now for just a minute. The name of our podcast is the NAHU Healthcare Happy Hour Podcast. So every week we include a toast of something that we should be celebrating. It can be about what we've been talking about or something else. So what's something that we can do to join you, the Catalyst for Payment Reform, in toasting to this week?
Well, I'll just share that when I started working with employers back in 1999, 2000, you know, trying to help them be bold purchasers and use their potential leverage for changing the healthcare system, it was really hard to find examples of employers doing innovative things. And when you asked me just a moment ago, share some examples, I hesitated because there were too many flooding my mind. So I want to toast to the employers and those who support them, including NAHU members, who have tried new things and who have, you know, paved the way for some successful approaches that we can continue to iterate on, you know, to help Americans get access to higher value healthcare. So here's to those employers and those they work with to make those strides forward.
Oh, what a great thing to toast to. I agree.
Cheers.
Thank you for joining us for this week's installment of the NAHU Healthcare Happy Hour, the official podcast of the National Association of Health Underwriters. For more information on NAHU's government affairs efforts, or to join as a member of NAHU, visit nahu.org.